rarely has there been a set of circumstances which seem so threatening to the future independence and impartiality of British broadcasting, and rarely is there the chance to debate the critical issue of media ownership. It's a subject which is seldom addressed at any length by the press, television and radio. Media proprietors have a mutual self-interest in limiting such discussion. But the attempt by Rupert Murdoch's media empire to take total control of the satellite broadcaster BSkyB could change the face of the media landscape in Britain. And because so much is at stake, the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom is devoting its first ever podcast to an in-depth exploration of the implications of the Murdoch bid. What would be the impact on the rest of the television industry, and especially the BBC? And what are the related repercussions for the national press, where News International already has a 37% market share? With me are the Labour MP Austin Mitchell, Stephen Barnett, Professor of Communications at the University of Westminster, Patricia Holland, lecturer at Bournemouth University, and Tim Gopsall, editor of Free Press, the magazine of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. First, Tim Gopsall, why are campaigners for media freedom so alarmed by the prospect of Murdoch buying total control of Sky?
This is already one of the biggest campaigns around the media that there's been for years. You haven't just got campaigning organisations like the CPBF, you've got all the national newspapers and all the other broadcasters all uniting to try and stop this happening. Because if it does, if the Murdoch Empire can put together the biggest broadcaster in Europe, which is Sky, and its national press, it will become such a powerful media voice that it will absolutely skew the way that we see the world.
From your perspective, Stephen Barnett, as Professor of Communications at the University of Westminster, do you think that there's an issue here that the public should be aware of, that there should be campaigns like the ones that are being mounted?
Yes, I absolutely do. And I think it's fair to point out that Murdoch has often been a bogey figure for a lot of people. And in the past, there's sometimes been a little bit of hysteria over anything that he's involved in. I have to say that in this case, I think Tim's absolutely right. And what we could see potentially is the birth of a media giant that will dwarf anything we've ever seen in this country. And will make life extraordinarily difficult, both for its own other competitors, commercial competitors, and for the BBC.
And why does this deserve a wider hearing? Why is it that it just seems to be confined to the media and city pages? There doesn't seem to be much debate yet about it in the country at large.
That's a very interesting question. I think one of the issues is that a lot of people will look at Murdoch and News Corporation and say, well, they already own Sky. That James Murdoch, his son, is the chairman, and we all think of Sky as a motor company. What's the problem? The problem is that at the moment he owns 39.1%. He's a minority shareholder. Once that becomes total ownership, it means he can do more or less what he wants. At the moment, there are independent directors who can ensure that the company is run for the benefit of Sky shareholders. There can't be any cross subsidies to News International newspapers, for example. Once he owns it completely, he can essentially do what he wants and use it to cross subsidise various elements of his media business.
Now, Patricia Holland, you've looked at the history of Murdoch's presence here on the British media scene. Looking back at that, do you think that there are lessons in what has happened before when Murdoch has tried to expand his media interests here in Britain?
Absolutely. I mean, he may well be a bogeyman, as Stephen says, but in some ways it's a very real threat from a very real bogeyman who's had a long-term campaign which dates way back to the 1960s when he first bought the Sun newspaper, turned it into a very populist paper, and had designs at that point to buy television stations. He campaigned throughout the 70s and the 80s, and it wasn't until the end of the 1980s when satellite television was launched that it was launched on the back of Murdoch's ownership of newspapers. By this time he owned the Times, and he used the Times to campaign against not only the BBC but the idea of public service broadcasting in general, and managed to persuade the Conservative government of the time that satellite broadcasting should be outside the normal scope of public service broadcasting, which controlled commercial as well as publicly funded broadcasters in this country.
Now, you mentioned the threat to the BBC that there was in previous years. Tim Copsall, as editor of the Free Press, do you see a threat at the moment if this takeover or this buyout of the total Sky share pool goes to Murdoch? Do you see a related threat to the BBC?
This could be the 1980s all over again, because Murdoch had a very close relationship with the Tory government in the 1980s, and now we have a new Tory government in all but name, very closely linked to News International. Their head of media communications is a former editor of the News of the World. There are many close links, and the Tories have said that they back the kind of policies, the media policies, that the Murdoch Empire wants, that is, to reduce the size of the BBC and let rip for the private companies. I think people should know how big Sky is. They don't realise. Sky's income is nearly £6 billion a year. Sky now has 10 million subscribers, and they pay an average of £500 a year. That's £5 billion straight off without advertising. Now, the £500 a year that people pay is more than three times as much as the BBC licence fee. The Sky's income is more than half again that of the BBC. People describe the BBC as a behemoth and a great giant dominating the media scene. Actually, Sky is much bigger. It's the biggest broadcaster in Europe already.
Stephen Barnett, you have looked at length at these sorts of issues. We now know, don't we, that the BBC is facing a very difficult set of financial circumstances. It's got a six-year freeze on its licence fee. It's being asked to undertake new responsibilities like funding the World Service. And we also know, of course, if we look at it in the long term, this could amount to something like a 16% reduction over the period in the BBC's income. How serious do you see this fact that it looks as though the Murdoch expansion might be unrestrained, but the BBC's continued operation could be severely curtailed?
It will be curtailed. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think the BBC faces some very serious questions now about how, what sort of cuts it can implement in order to stay within the much smaller budget that it's going to have. And I think just adding to Tim's point about the growth of Sky, not only is it a £6 billion business and forecast, I think, within 3 years to overtake the rest of the television industry put together, but while subscription television is expanding year on year, both licence fee funded and advertising funded television is retracting. So it's the only growth area, and there you have, and what is more, BSkyB takes 80% of subscription income, and it can only go up, and that is primarily because Murdoch has, from the very beginning, very cannily used sport as what he called his battering ram, buying up the sporting rights, first run live sports rights to major sporting events, so that the only place you can go if you want the big sports is Sky. No one is going to, at the moment, there are no organisations who can come near to challenging Sky for those sporting rights.
So, Patricia Holland, looking back, do you think then that there is a link here, that the BBC is now under threat, and that this is perhaps at the behest of media proprietors, something which we've seen in previous decades?
Well, there have been overt attacks. Rupert Murdoch attacked the BBC, attacked public service broadcasting at his very famous speech in 1989 to the Edinburgh Television Festival, where he said, you know, what public service broadcasting is to give the public what they want. I give the public what they want, so I'm a public service broadcaster. The rest is just rubbish. His son James echoed that 30 years later, 2009, by saying that the BBC was completely overweening, it was unpleasant, it was completely not in line with what television ought to be doing. And so there has been a consistent attack on the BBC from the whole of the Murdoch Empire.
Now, Austin Mitchell, there could hardly be in yourself a more seasoned observer of the media scene going back over many decades. Do you suspect that there is a political dimension to what we're seeing at the moment, in the sense that we are have this bid from the Murdoch group to take total control of Sky? It's also come at a time when the BBC's finances are under threat and have never been, it seems, so severely constrained. Do you think there is a political dimension?
Well, I'm suspicious that there has been some kind of deal behind the scenes between Murdoch interests and the Conservative government, a deal to belittle and hold back and cut back the BBC and to allow Murdoch's power and influence to grow. I mean, I think that's my suspicion. I can't prove it, but all the facts seem to indicate that way. But, I mean, let me say, my worry is the concentration of ownership, the enormous ownership power concentrated in the hands of one man. I'm an admirer of Rupert Murdoch. He employed me for a long time and he's certainly, I think, been very innovative. We owe satellite broadcasts, we owe Sky News to him largely, because the BSB plans were disastrously like a kind of BBC in the sky. He snuck in, developed this, and has made it profitable, and good luck to him. The problem now is he's got far too much power, the enormous power in the newspaper market, added to the power in the television production. If he's allowed to take over, take back, as it were, Sky, then it's enormous concentration. It's bigger than ITV, it's bigger than the BBC, it's extremely profitable, and it doesn't produce much in this country. And I think in the interests of diversity and public education, one man should not be allowed to have such a concentration of power.
But how is it going to be possible for campaigners who believe in the widest possible media ownership to stand up against the Conservatives when they say, look, as you readily acknowledged, Murdoch's track record has been one of investment in this country?
Yes, well, our front line is Ofcom, and I'm not very sure that that's a very strong and effective front line. I hope they'll the Office of Fair Trading will decide that this is not in the public interest, that one man should have such a concentration of power. If they don't, then there's nothing much we can do. I think the argument's got to be carried on and put vigorously, because these two blocks of power, the newspaper power and the television power, are self-supporting, self-sustaining. They scratch each other's backs. We shall be reading reviews in the Times and the Sun about watch this programme on Sky, watch that programme on Sky, don't watch this rubbish on the BBC, and they'll be encouraging and supporting each other that way. And I think the other point of leverage, which I don't think is likely to be operated by this government, but one can always hope, is the fact that this enormous empire pays very little tax. News International pays very little tax in this country. So it's true he's been innovative. It's true he's kept newspapers going like Today, which would have closed otherwise. It's true that he's financed the Times through loss-making. But the profits engendered by his newspaper interest and his television interest don't bear their share of burdens in this country that they should be doing to support our infrastructure and schools.
Now, I want to come back to you in a moment as to where you think we go next. You mentioned Ofcom, but first, Stephen Barnett, from your perspective at the University of Westminster, how do media observers react to this point that Austin Mitchell quite readily acknowledged, that News International has invested in its newspapers, it has invested in Sky Television, you had your concerns about the Premier League, but there's no doubt about it, Sky has invested money in sports broadcasting. So do you think that the broadcasting industry in Britain would be where it is today if News International hadn't been here and Sky hadn't
been
here?
Well, let's distinguish between investment in sport and investment in content. There is no question that Sky has invested very, very heavily in sport, and let's be fair, in sports production. So the standards of sports production are much higher than they were 20 years ago, and there are some very, very wealthy footballers with very large houses in Liverpool, and we won't go into where they spend their money, that is very different from... and incidentally, I kind of take issue with arguments that Premier League wouldn't be where it was today without that kind of money. There are plenty of other satellite operators, as we've seen in Italy and in Germany and in Spain. Their football is as good as ours, and they haven't had the Murdoch investment. The problem is that one of the things that BSkyB does not invest in is UK content, drama, comedy, factual programme, arts, children's programmes, and they routinely and consistently refuse to say how much they spend on original UK content, money that goes on performers, artists, comedy writers, actors, camera people, production companies, etc. Last week, in front of the Lords Communication Committee, we got a slight glimpse from Sky when they talked about a drama investment in the tens of millions. Tens of millions. The BBC, I think, invests something like £1.2 billion. Billion pounds. Sky is talking about tens of millions on the back of its £6 billion turnover. Now, that's a problem that needs to be addressed, and frankly, it's not going to be addressed simply by allowing this company to grow like Topsy without any kind of regulatory intervention.
So, Tim Gopser, what of this point that Murdoch does employ large numbers of journalists?
He
has invested in his newspapers. There is this debate about his investment in television, but what about on the newspaper?
He's also invested in news on television, and Sky News is generally considered to be a surprisingly high standard. It's all scoop obsessed and very, very, very flippant and ephemeral, but I mean, it does do a very good news service. One of the big worries is that if Murdoch gets control of Sky, Sky News can work in synergy with his newspapers, and if the regulations that currently require broadcasters, news broadcasters, to be fair and impartial are relaxed by the Tory government, which is what Murdoch has been calling for, then the whole empire could go much more right-wing in its coverage. And we have over the Atlantic the threat of Fox News in America, which gave birth virtually to the Tea Party movement, the big right-wing surge in American politics, and a lot of people are very worried that that sort of thing could happen to Sky News here.
Well, perhaps at this point...
Can I make one point about Sky News? A small point. I think it's terribly important. Tim's absolutely... I mean, I'm slightly more sanguine about Sky News at the moment than Tim is. I think it's actually a very effective and very high-quality news service. The issue about impartiality, I think, is a red herring. If Murdoch takes complete control of Sky News, you could operate an editorial agenda and stay within the statutory rules of impartiality while still having editorial influence. Not necessarily turning it into a right-wing news channel like Fox, but cross-promoting other News Corp properties. And there is editorial influence that is possible without crossing impartiality guidelines.
Now, perhaps at this point, we must look at the regulatory process and go through it. I mean, what we know is that the Business Secretary, Vince Cable, has referred the Murdoch bid of Sky to the broadcasting regulator, Ofcom. That could trigger a much fuller inquiry by the Competition Commission, but that would have to be ordered by the government, and running parallel with that, of course, are inquiries by the European Commission. Now, Austin Mitchell, as a Labour MP, you've heard that the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom is trying to kickstart a much wider debate. What would you say from the parliamentary side is going to be possible?
Well, all that's possible really is to carry on campaigning in Parliament and keep drawing what's happening to the attention of the public. Parliament is actually a very feeble voice compared to Sky News, isn't it? And compared to
But is Vince Cable persuadable? I mean, he is the business...
Oh, I think Vince Cable is persuadable, and I think he's sincere, but he's surrounded by a government. He is a captive of a government which I think has come to a deal with Murdoch interests.
You really feel that the deal has been done?
I think that there was a covert deal, yes. But irrespective of that, all we can do is keep broadcasting our concerns, but also pressing for more effective regulation. There's no reason why, for instance, there shouldn't be regulations requiring British content, as certainly existed in France. Well, linguistic content infringes it there, but up the quota of British content, require British production, require them to accept the same quotas for independent production that the BBC and ITV have operated, and bring pressure that way. I don't think the possibility of... I don't think Fox News situation is a possible here. But as you've just said, it is possible by interviewing one type of person, putting the story consistently one-sidedly, and Fox News calls itself fair and balanced, I know, but it isn't. It is able to concentrate on one side of the story without a change, but I don't think there would ever be a change, a reduction of the impartiality rules to allow a Fox kind of situation to develop.
Now, how, as a Labour MP, do you answer the point that, of course, we have been here before, there was, in many people's view, collusion between the governments of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown with the Murdoch Group, in the sense that there were no attempts to stop predatory pricing of that is, cutting the price of the Sun, for example. When it came to the complaints that Stephen Parnett has referred to about the near monopoly of football on the Premier League, the Blair government just turned a blind eye. So how do you square that as a long-standing parliamentarian?
Murdoch's power is enormous. I mean, if you wanted to read Woodrow Wyatt's diaries, the messages he was passing from Murdoch to Mrs. Thatcher to realise the influence is there. And certainly we were far too timid in regulation. In fact, the obsession became soft-touch regulation, and the powers of Ofcom were substantially reduced over the powers of the preceding regulators, and they were less than the powers of the regulators before then. So it's been a process of dilution, which has got to stop, because now we've reached the end where the market can't be allowed to decide these things. There has to be regulation of British content, of independent production, and a requirement on the part of the tax authorities, which are actually losing staff, that the profits generated in this country be taxed and kept in this country.
Stephen Barney, you've heard the frustrations of a parliamentarian there, a seasoned parliamentarian, about the difficulty that MPs have exercising control over this troubled area of media regulation. Can you just take us through this step by step? I mean, currently Ofcom, the media regulator, is looking at this bid. It could go to the Competition Commission, and it, and there's also the European investigation. Just take us through it. I mean, is it likely that any of them could actually block this deal?
The only person who can block the deal is the business secretary. Mm-hmm. And the Labour opposition's position is quite interesting, which is we will accept whatever the regulator says. So even the Labour opposition haven't said, we want this deal blocked. I think I'm right in that.
Well, you are currently advising the House of Lords Communication Committee, so I think we will take you as an expert witness on this
issue. Yes, that's right. But the current position is that Ofcom is going to issue its report by the end of the year, by the end of December. It will decide then whether there has been, whether there is a problem in terms of the public interest and media plurality. On that basis, the business secretary will decide whether to refer to the Competition Commission for a wider-ranging inquiry. They will then report back and make a recommendation to the Secretary of State, either whether the deal should go ahead or not, and he will make his decision on that basis. I have to say, I think Brussels, the European Commission, is a bit of a red herring. They are only looking at this in terms of the economic issues, and they are pretty certain to pass it on the basis that there was already a material interest by News Corp in Sky.
Do you think that the justification that the public interest is at stake, and that this must therefore go to a competition, a full competition inquiry, do you think that that is the case?
I would be astonished. I'd be absolutely astonished if Ofcom does not say there is a public interest issue here. And I have to say, to some extent, we have to get over the problem that this is Rupert Murdoch. I think there is an issue, particularly on the centre-left, that, you know, this is a right-wing figure, you know, we don't like him, we want to get rid of him, etc. That is really not the issue. The issue is, it doesn't matter if he was Mother Teresa or Nelson Mandela or the Archangel Gabriel. The fact is, it's a single individual, and no single individual should have the potential power that a single man running a single organisation would have if this deal goes through. On that basis, I expect Ofcom to say this should be referred.
The criterion is media plurality, And it's hard to see how a company that owns 37% of the British national press and the biggest broadcaster in the country doesn't raise an issue of media plurality.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the whole basis of British media regulation is based on the separation of broadcasting and newspapers. Newspaper companies are not allowed to own ITV companies. That's been the basis of regulation for the last 20, 30 years. But in Murdoch's sector, that's exactly what's happened. It's worth bearing in mind that regulators have turned Murdoch down before. About 12 years ago, he tried to buy Manchester United Football Club and was turned down by the new Labour government, and the business secretary at the time was Lord Mandelson, or Peter Mandelson as he was then. Now, Peter Mandelson is a much closer friend of Rupert Murdoch than Vince Cable is. And if Peter Mandelson can do it, then Vince Cable ought to be doing it. It's an interesting thought, actually, isn't it? For the Manchester United fans who are complaining about the American owners they've got now, that if they haven't got the Glazers, they've got Murdoch.
Well, Patricia Holland, can we take comfort from historical precedents like the one that Tim Gobson has just given us?
Well, I don't think so, actually. I mean, I think the history that Austin Mitchell just spelt out of what's happened to regulation in terms of the media, the fact that each regulator, as they've been brought in, each Broadcasting Act brought in another regulator with a lighter touch. You know, essentially, when ITV was set up as a commercial broadcaster, it was set up as part of a public service ecology. It had public service obligations. So public service didn't just mean publicly funded. It meant that those people who broadcast to this country had an obligation to broadcast certain types of programmes, to commission domestic programmes, and so on. And it was okay to be a commercial broadcaster and still be committed to public service. Now, that principle has gradually been eroded. And I think one of the worst things that's actually happened recently are the reduction of powers of Ofcom. Ofcom was originally set up, the Office of Communications. It was set up as not only as a light touch regulator, but as a deregulatory body. You know, and what could be worse within a context in which we have depended for our amazing television broadcasting on a plurality of different funding sources, a range of different programmes, and a huge input from many different areas? You know, what we need is a strong regulator who will regulate positively. Not a limiting regulator, a positive regulator, who will enable that sort of programming, a wide, diverse programming, including trash programs. You know, I mean, we don't just want. That's one of the difficulties of shrinking the notion of public service to it just means something worthy, education.
Let's remember, Pat's right in terms of the deregulation of progressive acts of Parliament. But let's remember that the 2003 Communications Act, while deregulating, did, thanks to the House of Lords, ironically, include precisely this provision to safeguard the public interest in terms of media plurality. And it's no credit to the Labour government at the time that they were prepared to let this go through without any safeguard of the public interest. But it is now in that Act, and in that sense, you could argue the public interest is more safeguarded, more strongly safeguarded than it had been before.
Austin Mitchell, finally, looking ahead to the future, you, as an MP, have had this long experience and you've seen these shifting patterns of media ownership. We now have a new Labour Party leader, Ed Miliband. He's promising a new generation are going to have a new look at the Labour Party's policies. Do you think that this whole question of media ownership, of the need to defend the impartiality, for example, of public sector broadcasting, do you think that that's going to actually be an issue which the new Labour Party is going to take up?
I think the issue of impartiality is there, the requirements are there, they'll stick. I don't think they'll be
done.
But my long history of is one of despair, actually, because it has been progressively weakened, and because of the increasing lack of ability to impose standards or requirements on this pluralistic media market. The excuse is always that you can't regulate, the market will provide. But it just ain't so, and I think there has to be some kind of regulation. I think Steve's been a bit optimistic about Ofcom. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ofcom its existence has been threatened, its staff has been reduced now, and it's never been a very brave and defiant organisation, has it? It's not, but one for taking firm stands, it has, thanks to the amendment in the House of Lords, now got to take the public interest into account, but the monopolistic situation is all conducted in different boxes. You can have a monopoly in newspapers with a separate market, you have a monopoly in television, separate market, but the two aren't merged together as we would like them to be in the concentration of power that's been produced in Murdoch's hand. So it does all depend on Ofcom. You clearly are hopeful. I'm just joining my hands in prayer.
I think you would have to twist yourself round in very many circles to come to a conclusion that the public interest is not under some kind of pluralism threat if this deal goes through. Even if you believe in a deregulatory, market-led, free market-based Ofcom, which I have to say I don't. I think there are people there who will still have the old ITC, the Independent Television Commission, philosophy. There aren't many of them. But they were very generous to
ITV in its dilution of its news requirements and its regional coverage requirements. Very generous indeed.
But they were generous, but there are still requirements, and there are still requirements on Channel 5, and there are, as I say, there are people at Ofcom who still believe in the remnants of public service
That's
broadcasting
true.
and believe in pluralism.
Well, finally, pulling this discussion to a conclusion, Stephen Barnett, what do you say campaigners should do now? What do you think are the chances of them achieving some check on this deal? Do you think that you're looking at it from your position as a professor of communications? Do you think that the campaigners should be manning the barricades and trying to stop this deal?
Well, listening to Austin, we clearly can't rely on our parliamentarians. he's obviously very pessimistic about the role of Parliament. No. I think what we need, actually, is Ofcom have set out, last Friday, they set out an invitation to comment. So they are looking for stakeholders, as they call them, or you and me, as the rest of us call them, anyone who wants to make a submission. And I think that what you want is as many people as possible to say, we are worried about this. We are worried about the power being invested in a single individual to have the most extraordinary power and influence through media over ordinary people in this country, and that has to be right. And the more people who say that, whatever we think of Ofcom, the more difficult it becomes for them to ignore popular protest.
Well, there could hardly be a better rallying cry, could there, for the campaign for press and broadcasting freedom, Tim Gopsell, editor of Free Press. How do you think the campaign is going to pick up and actually run with this one?
There's an awful lot of defeatism in discussion of media policy. The CPBF's been going for 20 years and everything has always been about to be a total disaster from what I've heard. The fact is that campaigning on media policy has been very successful over the years. Look at the BBC. We've still got an independent public service broadcaster. Let me say, despite its own management, who keep making concessions to government all the time, do you think that the Conservatives in the 1980s wouldn't have privatised the BBC or put it under subject it to advertising if they could? They can't, because the BBC is a popular institution, it's a public service, it's like the health service. The public love the BBC and want to keep it the way it is. And I think that campaigners have got something to their credit there. Now, this campaign has also had a success. The very fact that Vince Cable has referred the issue to Ofcom is a victory.
But the advice of Stephen Barnett is that that victory has got to be followed through.
It has, but that came after a campaign, a big mass campaign. The CPBF was working with an online campaigning organisation called 38 Degrees, which got 20,000 online signatures that were delivered to Vince Cable just before he took the decision. That campaign is still going. People can campaign themselves. We don't have to just rely on the MPs or even on the national newspapers and the other broadcasters who've made their protests. People can take part themselves. They can support the CPBF. They can do it through their union branches. The CPPF is affiliated to a number of national trade unions. We work very closely with unions, particularly the media unions, because they've got more at stake with this than everybody, than anybody, and they know what the problem is. So everybody can take part in this. They can write to their MP, they can sign online petitions, they can work through their union branches. That's the way to do it.
Thank you very much indeed. On behalf of the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, I'd like to thank Austin Mitchell, Labour MP, Stephen Barnett, Professor of Communications at the University of Westminster, Patricia Holland, lecturer at Bournemouth University, and Tim Gopsill, who we just heard from, editor of Free Press. Thank you.